I'm sorry to interrupt all the conversations, and we'll see if we can get the volume turned up. I apologize for interrupting all of you, but we got so much we want to get through here, and we want to get going. So thank you all. Thank you for coming. This is, well, first of all, I'm just really glad to see so many people here. I mean, there are probably two constituencies here that in the past may not have always gone to each other's lunches, you know. We got the environmental guys and we got the energy guys. And fortunately for eaters, you know, those have kind of been parallel and non-intersecting trajectories, and which is typical, you know, in Washington. You know, I mean, Washington is a town where we've got 13 goalies and no puck, you know, and it's so hard to get anything done in this town because the town is designed, you know, to not let things happen. Now, that happened for a very good reason. You know, there were 47 men, unfortunately, we at that time we only let men be in government, but 47 men that signed the Declaration of Independence, and during the War of Independence, 30 of them were either killed or tracked down and locked up in prisons, and so they had a bitter experience for having signed the Declaration of Independence. So when they started forming a government, the central premise among all of them was, we're never going to let one guy ever do that to us again. Okay, we're never going to let a, you know, King George ever do that to us again. So they intentionally divided the country, the government, I should say, in very profound ways so that you could not get anything done on your own. You had to cooperate with other people to get something done. We call it checks and balances. And this is a country where, you know, we make mistakes only when we move fast. But, boy, we have a brilliantly slow system. I mean, we've worked out. So this is a town that is designed, you know, to foster the advocacy of different groups, but it's hard to bring it together. And it's a, you know, town of mighty fortresses where people don't want to get out of their fortress and meet each other on an open playing field. And so sometimes it's hard to do that. That's what this project was about, really. And I was talking with Jonathan earlier when we were just assembling to say that, you know, both sides were nervous about this effort. We didn't know each other. You know, that's one of the problems in this kind of a landscape, you know, where we're so used to our tribal affiliations. We love going to our own conferences and seeing the people that already agree with us, you know. But it's really hard to get out and then start opening up and talking about issues that cut across. Now, we know we're living in an era where, you know, the economy is falling apart. We've got people are finally starting to realize the accelerating nature of the global warming crisis that we're facing. We've got an energy infrastructure that the reason we've got such high prices is because energy infrastructure hasn't kept up with demand. You know, all of this is just all around us. And, you know, no one group can solve the problem on their terms alone. You know, it's just that isn't the way it's going to get worked out. We cannot afford to trash the environment as we try to dig out of this recession. But we can't afford to basically let the continued choke points and bottlenecks of the energy industry keep us in the recession. You know, it's all tied together now. So we're going to have to figure out how do we talk to each other, how do we work with each other, and it's kind of scary. So this was an interesting experience, and I will tell you, I'm just so proud for the partnership that we had. You know, this WI was a solid professionals and tough friends. You know, we had more than our share of very interesting and spirited conversations, but there was always a sense that we needed to work with each other, and I think that's the spirit of the time that we're in. So I just want to say thank you, Jonathan, to you and Jonathan Lash. He's off at Davos right now, and I said, oh, he left better behind. Jonathan Pershing will be more than enough to handle this. But wanted to have a chance to share with all of you this work. We think it's actually solid. It's a solid blueprint on how we can be collaborating together across the board in an integrated way on these problems. So let me turn it to my colleagues. I don't know who's going to start first. And Frank, you are? Frank Verastro. Let me first turn to Frank and say again, thank you, and we look forward to working with everybody here. I'm glad you all came. Thanks.
Thank you, John. And thank you all for coming. It's not the most hospitable day outside, but we thought that we would lure you with a free lunch in this town. Let me echo some of John's remarks. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. On the panel this morning, Jonathan Pershing is director of Energy, Environment, and Pollution at WRI. Sarah, one of the primary authors of this report, is a fellow here at CSIS out of the Energy Department. And Kate Zyla, also in the back there. Kate. Kate was also a primary author, and she's also a new mom. So we're glad to have her here today as well. This report wouldn't have been possible without a group of other people, too. Jenna Clearly, Britt Staley, Dave Pumphrey, a host of reviewers and advisors. We had more than our share of outside commenters and reviewers that helped the process along and kept us in balance, and that is kind of what this is all about. When we looked at this partnership with WRI, the idea of teaming up with an environmentally sensitive group that had expertise and heft in that area with the security and energy focus that we thought CSIS brought, it's a common misconception that when you put energy security and climate change together, you always find a single set of solutions that work for both. And aside from efficiency and some low-emissions fuels, more often than not, it requires trade-offs. And this trade-offs and this balance is what the policymakers are going to need to do. As you move to a new green system, because clearly our current system is unsustainable for a variety of reasons, and I'll go through some of them, that you also need to keep the current system robust until you have something at scale to replace it with. And this takes decades, not just months or years. So this president is a transition president, and we ought to keep that in mind. But we need to move forward. Every day we get new evidence that suggests that just the specter of climate change is a national security risk. It also promotes instability around the world. It's going to change water patterns. It's going to change mobility, especially in areas where there's large population growth. And a lot of that is in sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East, where we get a lot of conventional energy production from. So from an energy security perspective as well, it's important that we do this today. The plan for this afternoon is to go through different pieces of the report. I'm going to turn to Jonathan for some opening comments. Sarah's going to take us through the recommendations, and then we're going to have some sum up and Q's and A's at that point. Jonathan, let me just for introductory remarks, and then we'll turn to the presentation.
Thanks very much, Frank, and I wanted to thank John as well for the opening remarks that he made. I think as John and Frank have both noted, the context of putting together a group like this, I think, is very consistent with what we as an institute see going forward. One of the areas where WRI has sought to provide value in the global conversation is through partnerships. And we've been in many, many partnerships. All of them are difficult for different reasons, because you never put together a group of people who agree on everything. You always put together a group of people who have different perspectives, because that adds richness and ultimately is a requisite if you're going to have any kind of significant outcome. This one is, in some ways, no different. In other ways, has some unique characteristics because of the area that we were working on. And those characteristics, I think, were manifest in the kinds of recommendations that we've made and the balance that we've sought and framing things not where you can say, well, I like this piece, but I don't like that piece, was part of the outcome. We've provided a package. We think if we put it together, it's extremely robust. It's got components that will let us move from our perspective in a sustainability manner that I think is shared by CSIS. Sustainability is now defined to be inclusive. It's an environmental sustainability and a security sustainability. It's economically sustainable, and it has social welfare provisions that collectively make us a global society that works more effectively. That vision we can all share, and that was the easy part. The hard part came when we tried to make all the detailed recommendations. And so we'll walk through those, and you'll see why we've come to where we've come from. But before we begin that slideshow and kind of walk through it, I wanted to also emphasize one additional point. It really has been a great pleasure to work with CSIS. I know that our team from WRI, which has quite a lot of energy depth and quite a lot of work on the environmental side, found enormously interesting and engaging our conversations with the security emphasis that Frank and his team brought. And the quality of the report, I think, reflects the collective depth that we brought and the synergies between our collective teams. It really has been a great pleasure. And thanks to all of you both for coming, and many, many of you for providing the kinds of comments and feedback that gave value and credibility to the product. So, Frank?
All right, so starting with the slide set. So when we looked at challenges, and this is not unlike several studies that you've seen at this point, but this is the unsustainability of the system. We identified at least a half dozen of key observations of the current system. And the first is that demand is increasing and the supplies are more concentrated. On the demand side, most projections, even with the economic downturn, still talk to the issue of by 2030 we're looking at 40 to 50% more energy needs. But the demand centers are going to change. So instead of typically being the OECD or the developed world, a lot now is going to be coming from the non-OECD or the emerging and developing economies, which have different energy needs and different access and technologies to which they can exploit the energies that they have. Clearly, high carbon fuels are abundant. This is not a peak oil type study. And when you look at the range of resources that are available in the world, this includes the unconventionals, the ability to convert. When you add into that the fact that they're more difficult to produce, harder to transport and move over longer distances, and the fact that now you deal with climate change, so the issue of the carbon footprint is very important. And we'll actually show you from a Western Hemisphere perspective how on a security basis there's things you can do, but it runs up against your environmental goals. The market volatility, if there's two things we learned from the 2007-2008 experience, is that business cycles still matter. We still have the leads and lags that we've always had. And in an uncertain environment, those leads and lags with the investment climate, it's just that much more difficult. Second piece is that price elasticity also still works, albeit at a higher level. When in the past we looked at $2.50 for gasoline, now it's $3.50, $3.75. And the question is whether the demand reductions that we've seen in the United States, and they were considerable. It was almost a million barrel a day year-on-year reduction. Whether that stays in a lower price environment, and are there things you can do in the short term to make sure that we keep on that path? The geopolitics and the dynamics that are shifting. In 1997, the G8 provided 65% of global GDP. In 2007, it was down to about 57%, and the projections are that by 2015, it'll be in the 40s. When we talk about engaging on climate change or nonproliferation, we talk about the G8 or the G2 or the G20. A different group of players are entering the scene and emerging. They're playing new roles, regional and global, and it's actually challenging institutions because we're developing a new set of rules. So we're going to have to adapt to that as well. The urgent need of climate change, and Jonathan will talk more about this, but the fact that it does present a national security challenge going forward, not only in terms of climate, but in food and agriculture, energy production, and in populations. And then the fact of the global economic crisis. Most people think that the economic downturn clearly will affect demand. It will reduce consumption of energy and of fossil fuels. And in that sense, it also reduces or slows emissions growth. These are good things. It also slows supply, and you're starting to see the impact it has on new investment for supply. So as we come out of this, whether it's the end of 2009 or the beginning or middle of 2010, whether it's a V or a U makes a lot of difference. And we could actually be in a situation a year and a half from now, not all that different from what we looked at in the last 18 months. So we need to avoid that. And to the extent that we can use this time wisely, it makes an awful lot of sense to do so. So looking at some of the graphs, and I won't go into these in too much detail, but the first one on the left-hand side of the screen is just a projection. This could be IEA, could be EIA, could be the World Monetary Fund. The fact that global energy growth, it's just business as usual, still looks in 2030 an awful lot like it looks today. Part of that is scale, and part of that is the amount of time it takes to change the system. And today you'll hear a lot of resetting the system, managing the transition, getting to the future that you want, and we've broken it up in three different steps. It's 75% fossil fuel dependent, 85% fossil fuel dependent in the world as a whole. If you took a subsection of this as just the developing economies, it's over 90% fossil fuel. And coal is the king in the developing world. So if you look at India and China, and then you look at the carbon footprint, it gives you an idea of the lift that you have to make. And it has to be public and private. We have to stop demonizing industries as we go forward. We have to work together and solve this, just as we worked collaboratively on this project. Just one quick thing on the renewables. If you look at renewables, it's 8% roughly, and that includes hydro. Double, triple, quadruple it, there's still a role for conventional fuels and the time that it takes to make that transition. Right-hand side of the screen is just a kind of a cross-section of what demand patterns look like, and all it really picks up here is that the non-OECD economies, because of population growth, standard of living, and GDP, expected GDP growth, will become larger energy consumers. We're at about parity now, and the projection is that 60% of new energy demand growth between now and 2030 will be from the developing world. You can go to the second slide. Second slide, this is a typical slide. We actually use this in the NPC report. Red barrels are conventional fuels. Blue barrels for you in the back are non-conventional fuels. Western Hemisphere, if you look at shales, coal, and oil sands, has a lot of unconventional fuels. So if you look at just from a security perspective, you can actually look to make liquid fuels and other fuels for power generation from these sources. But it comes at a huge environmental cost. It takes a lot of water, takes a lot of energy, new investment in infrastructure, and then you have the climate change impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So if you were just to look at this from a decidedly security point, you'd come out with a different recommendation. And that's part of this collaboration effort. So when you try to balance, we put together a triangle that looks at economic pieces, foreign policy, energy security, and then environmental security, you have to find the common ground in the middle. And almost everything besides energy efficiency requires a trade-off. Lower right-hand side of the screen talks about the conventional resource distribution. And the resources are not where necessarily the new population growth centers are, and certainly not where the demand centers are. So there's this imbalance, which is going to put a lot of stress on infrastructure, transportation, security, and the environment. If we had put a coal slide up there, you would have seen that the United States, resource-wise, is the Saudi Arabia of coal. We have Western coal and Eastern coal. One's low BTU, the other is high BTU, high and low sulfur contents. But also when you look at mining and the burning of coal without carbon capture, huge implications for emissions. On the other hand, if you were to take down the current system, our power generation system is 50% driven by coal use. In the near term, since you can't scale up nuclear, still have problems of intermittency with renewables, natural gas seems to be a likely plug-in for this transition period. And while we've been in surplus for natural gas for the past couple of years, it's largely because of the unconventionals, which have a lot of technical problems, use a lot of water, require a certain price, and have huge decline rates. So we could actually transition back to a shortage or a deficit situation in a matter of 18 months.
So let me turn from that specific focus on the energy side to talk briefly about some of the climate impact questions and why this collaboration ended up being so important. The slide on the left side shows the trend, and this is not a projection. These data are measured, and we've got an annual five-year mean as well as the annual numbers going forward from 1880 through 2004. It's continued over the period since then, so the trend has been just the same. Last year was the eighth warmest year on record. The year before was the second warmest year on record. If you look at the last 10 years, they are eight of the warmest years on record, and in the 15, you're in the top 10. It's not statistically possible unless some fundamental shift is happening. It's clearly reflected here. Projecting forward, we end up seeing quite substantial damages. And one of the things that I think that we agreed on as a group was this isn't what's contentious. The contentious part is not the science. The contentious part is what do you do? But the science is pretty unambiguous. And it speaks explicitly not just to environmental impacts that may affect local ecosystems. It speaks to water availability. It speaks to coastal zones. It speaks to inundation by flood. It speaks to an increase in hurricane damage. There was an article that I saw in the Washington Post just last week that talked about 90% of the western slope of Colorado's lodgepole pines now being dead. That's a function of a change in global average temperature, which in Colorado has been manifest by only about a 2-degree average change, which has led to a change in water availability and has changed the insect infestation rate, leading to morbidity in the entire lodgepole pine series. I was there this summer. The entire hillside on Rocky Mountain National Park is brown. These are pretty immediate consequences. You have standing timber in places like this, there's enormous and immediate economic costs, and those are modest. You start looking at serious costs, and they play out in places like the Pentagon study that look at the security implications of water declines in the Mideast or water declines in Bangladesh or declines in the Indian subcontinent, and they fundamentally alter your picture of the scale of damage. We're looking at 250 million people without adequate water in one subpart of East Asia. So the slide on the right, the part on the right, looks at some of those damages. And for those of you in the back of the room, the issue really is this, the color scenario. Across the top, we have temperature change measured in degrees Celsius. Somewhere around 2 degrees, you fade out from what's yellow, which is kind of a cautionary level, to what's red. And red, unsurprisingly, looks pretty dangerous. And the kinds of things that we worry about are food production. We worry about water availability. We worry broadly about the ecosystems which provide a substantial share of the livelihoods for the world's population. We worry about extreme events. Those are things like the tornadoes and the hurricanes and the droughts. And we begin even more to worry about these unforeseen discontinuities. Historically, the system has not behaved on a smooth linear path. It's jerky. It goes forward for a while, and you think it's okay, and then all of a sudden it changes abruptly, and the geological record is filled with those abrupt changes where massive discontinuity occurs. We've seen historically the North Atlantic circulation stopping. We've seen historically that at one point the North American continent was covered by a mile of ice, and today it's not. These are abrupt changes that may be triggered at some threshold that we're not yet aware of. So if that's the climate space, and that's the energy space that Frank has outlined, where do the intersections occur? One of the first things we wanted just to look at are some of these numbers on the investment supply side and how they might link in. This particular piece of data comes from the International Energy Agency. I had the privilege of serving as the director of the Energy and Environment Program at the IEA when we began doing some of this work in the late 1990s. They've continued it since I've joined WRI, and I think it's very powerful and quite deeply researched. It's got, I think, a substantial robustness to the analysis. And what we see here is the distribution in terms of the investment in power, in oil, and in gas. You can see fairly modest investment in biofuel space and in renewables. What you've got here, though, is how it's been divided out. And we're looking at trillions of dollars of investment. This is a huge scale. So it's not that we're looking to find brand new money. This is what we anticipate investing under the reference scenario of the IEA without making new policies. Without making new policies. So the question is not so much where do we find money. The question much more is, how do we want to shape the money that we're spending? What's the intent if we want to solve these kinds of security problems, which this does not speak to, that Frank addressed? If we want to solve the kinds of climate impact issues that I was trying to frame, how do we redirect these kinds of revenues? Well, here's a framing that has been proposed by the United Nations Climate Change Convention Secretariat, which is the body that's seeking to facilitate the negotiations of a new international agreement on climate change. And they're trying to give us some sense about the scale of investment that might be required, and this is measured in billions of dollars, U.S. dollars, in the year 2030. The scale should be noted. On the left-hand side, it's billions of dollars. At the top end is 160. In the middle is about $80 billion. Contrast that with the $25 trillion investment in the energy infrastructure, in the energy sector. This is not unmanageable. We can do this, but it requires a political shift from where we have been into where we might choose to be. And in order to get that, we have to manage not just these climate change constraints, we have to manage the security problems. And the way we were defining security broadly is to encompass not just the issue of supply discontinuities, but to address the question of price, to address the question of economics, to address the question of reliability. All of those are framed as part of a larger context for thinking about security into which this picture of new investment to add this new climate component must be framed. And we have capacity, and it's not as big as you might think, and it needs to be across multiple technologies. So here's just another framework for it. We don't currently have the institutions that provide this kind of money. On the left side in red, we need about $200 billion give or take some, on an annual basis globally to manage these questions. And while it's about the right size for foreign direct investment, none of the funds or the structures that we've got to manage our joint security programs or our climate programs are scaled at the right level. So just to reiterate where Frank concluded before we then launch into the discussion and specifics of the program, these are all intersecting pieces. We have the climate change piece, which I addressed. We have the energy security piece, which frames the underlying energy components. We have an economic piece. If we don't get it right, the intersections will kill us. If we get it right, we might be partly in that middle space, and we have to think about where the trade-offs are, where we can find the best synergy, where we can minimize those costs, because missing this means that we're kind of outside the box in a pretty red area for the environment, a pretty red area for security, and clearly a pretty red area for the economy.
Okay, well, that's certainly enough to start thinking about. One of the things I'd like to just mention, I have the privilege of being up here on behalf of my colleagues who all worked very hard putting these recommendations together. So I'm going to work to make sure that I reflect them accurately, but Jonathan and Frank should, of course, jump in anytime I leave something out. There's a great deal in this roadmap at a very high level that we think is going to be very helpful for managing some of the trade-offs that Jonathan and Frank have outlined so far. The roadmap itself is divided into three sections, and the three sections are fairly significant. They are, as we've put them, a new framework for thinking about energy policy. In many ways, the Obama administration and new representatives in government and companies as well are really just at the forefront of managing a transition to what we call a secure, low-carbon energy future. The types of investments that we need to make that Jonathan just outlined, the type of challenges that face the system before us really do take decades, if not a century, to affect. The system is massive. It will take a long time to shift or even bend the curve a little bit in terms of emissions or improving our security environment. However, that doesn't mean that there can't be near-term action, and that doesn't mean that this administration can't have a really important and impactful role in setting out a new framework for thinking about these challenges and setting us on the right path. So with that in mind, we divided the roadmap into three sections. The first is establishing a vision for the future. The recommendations in this section speak specifically to articulating a long-term vision about what energy security and climate change goals are against which different policies can be measured. We think it's really important that having a clear articulation of what dealing with climate change and improving energy security actually mean and what that looks like over the longer term is critically important to the success of these efforts. We have an example in the roadmap that talks about the Bretton Woods system. Before everyone tells me how good that's not working these days, the recognition was that, you know, in a post-World War II environment, there was a belief that greater economic prosperity and overall global security would be benefited by having a liberalized trading system. And a vision was set out, and it has been improved and improved upon and changed over time to reflect a changing reality and the changing nature of sort of global economic activity and commercial frameworks. Similarly, this type of vision will need to evolve over time. It won't be perfect at the outset, but it is certainly something through which a new administration and administrations going forward can set forward these policies and measure these principles and measure policies against them over time. The second is putting the energy system on the right path. And this is essentially resetting the system. If we had an easy button or a reset button, this would be the section of recommendations. And it's essentially this idea that we have a complex and often contradictory system of policies and incentives at multiple levels throughout the United States and the world, quite frankly, that don't necessarily speak to or promote the kinds of changes that one might need in order to reach the vision that we established in the first section, one that balances the need to address the urgent challenges of global climate change, but also improve energy security and ensure that we have adequate, affordable, and reliable energy supplies to meet economic growth. And so these recommendations in this section talk about resetting the system of incentives and priorities so that the private sector, governments, people understand what the new priorities are going forward when making these types of decisions. And the final section is the managing the transition section. And this is an explicit recognition of the fact that there are tensions between the decisions that we have to make about energies and technologies and policies in order to balance our climate change and energy security goals and priorities. And so all of the recommendations in that section deal explicitly with trying to balance those trade-offs, to recognize the tensions that exist between those two goals, and somehow find a common path forward that allows us to use what is largely much needed energy fuel sources, but in a way that satisfies the climate greenhouse gas emissions requirements, or in a way that that allows us to have more climate-friendly technology and fuel options in a more secure way. I also like to just mention that for each of the recommendations that we'll go through, because a lot of them can be well without longer than a 4-year or even an 8-year time frame, we do also recommend proposed first steps for this new administration in particular. The last thing I wanted to mention, because we didn't say it explicitly, most of these recommendations that we're about to present deal very much with the United States. And it's not because we think that the United States is somehow separate or apart from the international community. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Both climate change and energy security are global issues, have to be dealt with globally, and we do sort of say this throughout the report. But we do recognize that the key to productive global engagement is going to be the United States putting its house in order on these issues and finding a way to proceed that we think is viable over the long term. So the first and only recommendation in establish a vision for the future is probably, as you would guess it, establish that vision. Have a vision. Know where you want to go because you hopefully want to get there. The main recommendation in this section is to integrate energy security and climate priorities into all aspects of domestic and international policymaking. We think it's really important not just to have globally agreed to climate goals. It's important not just to have an energy bill. We've in fact had quite a few energy bills in the last couple years. Not just to have a domestic climate program, but to take these policies and priorities, these goals, the things that we're talking about dealing with energy security and climate change, and integrate them into other aspects of policymaking as well. Because so very many parts of what we do as a government or what we do as a society actually do impact energy and the climate in significant ways. So it'll be very important to integrate those priorities out as well. And the first step towards integrating those climate and energy security principles into other priorities is to articulate the vision, but also to build upon existing systems within the federal government to coordinate energy and climate policy throughout. And so we have been working on this roadmap for a long time. At one point in time, we said we needed some sort of White House coordinator, so we can check that off. We have the White House coordinator now, but it's really important, I would say, that we also need to make sure that not only the coordination happens, but also through all of the other agencies that have something to do with energy or climate, that they understand what their explicit actions are as well. And so we did find sort of the climate change policy program and review architecture that is up and existing as one way that a White House coordinator and other administrative officials who might be interested in sort of integrating these priorities can work together in a system that's up and running and people are familiar with. So that was the first recommendation, and that was in establishing a vision. The second recommendation deals with resetting the system to put us on the right path. It is quite obviously establishing a price on carbon throughout the U.S. economy. It's impractical to think, at least we believe, that people will learn to value emissions reduction without a price on carbon throughout the U.S. economy. There are certain things about the price. It needs to be stable. It needs to be long-term. It needs to present long-term certainty to businesses in order so that they can make decisions about their investments. But it also needs to be effective enough that it actually does hasten our development towards low-carbon fuels. Whether it's a cap-and-trade or a carbon tax program. We think that those are principles that are important going forward. And the first step towards this goal is for the new administration to outline their priorities for a domestic climate change program and work with Congress to make sure that passage that will limit greenhouse gas emissions while recognizing the energy security concerns of such a price as well are communicated in a very clear and transparent way. This also reflects the concern that how you set the price, the degree to which how high it goes, how fast it increases, will have concrete effects on the reliability and the affordability of energy. And so there are possible negative implications of having a price that goes too high, too fast, that people might not be able to afford energy, or that simply is so low that it just ends up being a tax on companies. There's a lot of, as many of you are very familiar with, a lot of sort of more granular issues that we didn't sort of come to an agreement on within the context of this recommendation, but we do realize that when you're making a price on carbon, that these are things we have to consider. It will take a long time, but over to actually write the policy and to stand up a program and put it in place, but eventually it will be a money revenue sort of generator, so that's positive. We did put the recommendation that we think that money should be used to sort of bolster the energy and climate goals that we've put forward. So reducing the impact of cost for low-income housing, the increased cost of energy for low-income households, supporting the development of low-carbon technologies, and sort of several other recommendations. This recommendation, still within the same category, is to establish a public financial commitment to the energy security and climate change challenges. This is a very explicit recognition that taking action on these challenges is going to cost money. We probably should say that again. Taking action to address these challenges is going to cost money, but the cost of inaction over the longer term will be more expensive. And I'm going to stray for a second, personal opinion aside. We were writing this within the context of this dialogue over green energy opportunity versus having to spend money in a time of hard economic times. It is not a foregone conclusion that the way in which the government is going to spend money will actually lead to economic benefit, but it can. And if you do it well, which we recommend doing it well, could actually have some significant public benefit, not to mention some of the things that you would spend money on that would actually deal with both of these challenges are things that you do need to be spending money on. And we identified four key areas. The first was to modernize and improve efficiency in energy infrastructure, so encourage public-private partnerships to create new and improved infrastructure. Infrastructure is a big issue going forward, and it's getting a lot of attention right now, especially in the stimulus package. Investing in worker training. This is an issue in all sectors of the energy industry. And we think there should be a federal financial commitment to workforce education and retraining. Increased financial and technical support for adaptation to climate change. While a lot of what we recommend does deal with mitigation, adaptation is something that we're going to need to think about for all of the reasons that Jonathan mentioned, not only in the United States, but also in other countries as well. And the final one is increased funding and improved spending for low-carbon energy technology, research, development, and demonstration. R&D funding levels should be ramped up dramatically, 2 or 3 times higher than current levels, and sustained until at least 2030. We also have a sort of a text box talking about how important it is to think about the way that we're doing research, development, and demonstration. There's been a lot of talk about different approaches and how we might need to revamp to reflect the urgent timeframes in which we need to see these changes taking place in the development of new technologies and the deployment of these technologies taking place on a scale that or a pace that matches some of the challenges that we face. The first step is to provide investments for low-carbon energy and efficiency through a variety of mechanisms and managed through institutions with the capacity to assess the long-term value of projects and encourage private sector spending. This reflects both our belief that there's probably no one right way to do any of this, but there will probably be a multitude of vehicles for getting the spending done to make sure that it's done at sort of the federal level as well as the state level, state and local level. And that it should be managed through institutions that are capable of executing them. So we have some ideas in text boxes about how to do that. The next recommendation is to provide private sector energy incentives to promote low-carbon fuels and technologies and remove barriers to their deployment. And this really gets to the heart of this recommendation, this idea that we have a system of incentives, regulations, and policies that have evolved over time at a multitude of levels throughout the United States, and that it's really important that we evaluate those incentives and make sure that they do, in fact, lead us in a direction that we want to be going in order to reach the vision that we've established. And again, this is the first step, is really to look at what's been happening at the state and federal level and to align the sort of economic and financial incentives and remove those barriers to promote investment in low-carbon energy technologies. It is not to preclude or say that we need to do something in the opposite direction for other kinds of technologies, but it is to sort of look at the system, see what we have, reset it so that we can unlock the sort of spirit of innovation, the activities that the private sector will largely be doing, and communicate more clearly and directly what it is, where it is exactly as a nation we'd like to be going. The next recommendation is to engage constructively in the development of an effective international response to climate change and energy security concerns. It is one recommendation, but it's our international recommendation, so there are a lot of subcomponents to it. This entire project was predicated on the idea that the U.S. really needs to become a global leader, a strong global leader, given the magnitude of these challenges, and engage on some of these issues. And so as we articulate a new vision domestically for climate change and energy priorities, that we need to find ways to engage constructively in the international community to do to put forward these policies and really articulate sort of a new international energy policy. This includes a number of different subcomponents. But really, we often saw that this offers a unique opportunity for us to sort of alter the geopolitics of energy, some of the dynamics that Frank were talking about, promote innovation and entrepreneurialism, and engage in rapidly developing countries in these challenges that they face as well. So we see this as engaging and finding an agreement in through the UN process to come to agreement on climate change. We offer some suggestions, recognizing that that having a global agreement on climate change under the UN framework in time to replace the current Kyoto structure is extremely important, but it won't by itself be adequate in terms of our ability long-term to meet our climate goals or our energy security goals. So we have a number of recommendations about bilateral and multilateral international activities and partnerships that can help develop technologies, deploy technologies, deal with some of the issues that we'll need to also address to sort of bolster the cooperation that we have under sort of the sort of more global UN climate framework. We also think that it's important to take existing groups, regional and bilateral cooperation groups that deal with energy, with trade, with economic issues, and integrate our energy security and climate priorities into those as well. The first step, because it's sort of immediately on the horizon, is to build support for an international climate change agreement under the UN and manage the linkages between the domestic and international policies that we will largely be developing simultaneously, and build support, especially within sort of domestic political constituencies, for technical and financial and capacity-building assistance to other countries as well. The next recommendation is to invest in infrastructure and the technology necessary to transform the transportation system while promoting denser, more transit-friendly land use patterns. We did sort of look at the transportation sector in isolation or sort of called it out in this one section, because we do think that there is a need to sort of use these opportunities to drive a transformation to something that is not entirely dependent on a single fuel source like the transportation system currently is today. The transportation system we have, like much of our energy system, is decades, if not a century, in the making. And it'll take a long time to be able to transfer to something new. And so we put forth a number of recommendations about how to make the vehicles we use more efficient, how to make the society, local communities' land use patterns and mobility patterns and people's behavior about how they get around and how they do things different as well. So we have a number of recommendations dealing with how to transform the transportation system. And I think let's go to the first step. And sort of recognizing that sort of a more sustainable transportation system that does promote efficiency, promote low-carbon fuel options as well, in much-needed infrastructure improvements, there is a near-term opportunity coming up, both in the stimulus package but also in the transportation bill, to articulate some of these new priorities for how we think about transportation, how it should we want to be shifting to a more diversified fuel base, low-carbon fuels, more efficient vehicles, more efficient land use patterns, thinking about some of those issues as we're dealing with things like the transportation bill and in the stimulus package. We also have a very interesting – I'm going to say it's very interesting because we're working on it – but we have a very interesting paper that we continue to work on, which deals specifically on this point, exploring some of the different options and the different technology platforms for transport for a new or modernized or somehow different transportation system. And one of the interesting things that we've been exploring is the potential for an electrified transportation system. We think that there are a number of vehicle and fuel alternatives out there. One of the interesting things, and again, this is sort of Sarah's opinion, is that a lot of the infrastructure improvements that we've been talking about in terms of a smart grid, in terms of being able to decarbonize the electric power sector as well, also have benefits for the transportation sector. So not only thinking about the transportation sector by itself, but thinking about it in conjunction with other major infrastructure improvements that we're going to need to make, certainly does seem to give ample reason to look at things like plug-in hybrid electric vehicles and electric vehicles over the longer term in a very serious way. This brings us to part three, which is managing the transition, really sort of getting at the tensions and sort of trade-offs between choices. Everything we thought in the first section was sort of resetting the system, reprioritizing choices, making sure that certain technologies and fuels were prioritized and sort of reflect the vision of where we hope to go in the future. This deals explicitly with trying to manage the transition between here and there and those tensions. This recommendation is to promote energy efficiency, renewable energy, and transmission infrastructure, measures that contribute to both energy security and climate goals. Energy efficiency, as Frank and Jonathan both said before, sort of in our triangle of security and energy, environment and foreign policy and security, environment and energy priorities, definitely do hit the middle and satisfy all three. Renewable energy has the potential to have some significant security and climate benefits as well. And then transmission infrastructure in the near term allows us to bring on greater amounts of renewable energy, helping our climate goals, but also improves energy security within our definition, which we have reliability as a consideration. The first step is to implement more aggressive energy efficiency and renewable energy standards and programs and develop a prompt start to a smart grid design. These are all things that we think will help us improve efficiency, improve the diversity of fuels through a greater share for things like low-carbon energy. There are a lot of things that the federal government can do now, a lot of things that's within their purview. But also there's a lot of things, as we said before, that is not within their purview. It's something that sort of state governments take care of as well. We think that they should move more aggressively in efficiency standards and as we've been talking a lot about with sort of the stimulus package discussion, promote a smart grid, which allows both improvement in security, but also allows us to take better benefit of sort of efficiency gains and incorporate renewable energy. And this one's a bit complicated, but it's pretty straightforward at the same time. Reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from technologies that contribute to energy security and make low-carbon technologies more secure. There's a whole series of technologies and fuel choices out there that we seem to have this sort of conversation about that we're trying to determine whether they're good or they're bad. And they're probably not either. They probably just are. And some of them have some of them are ample and abundant fuels, as Frank had said, that have relatively worse greenhouse gas emission profiles. And some of them are cleaner options that might cause some security concerns. And we think you have to have the ability to address both and make both of them an option. Within the category of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from energy secure technologies, we have key technologies like carbon capture and sequestration, recognizing the abundant coal reserves in the United States and other countries around the world, and recognizing that it will take a long time to remove those fuels from the mix, and that we might want the option of being able to use them going forward. Carbon capture sequestration is going to be one of the key options going forward for doing that. It's been used around the world, but not yet at scale or in enough of the geological formations with the combinations of technologies yet. So we advocate that the federal government spend some money and time investing and deploying those technologies. The second is to expand the sustainability requirements for biofuels. Biofuels have seen a lot of growth in the United States and around the world, but we've also seen some of the negative implications, there's a big debate about that as well, but the food security, other sustainability requirements for biofuels. Some of the second generation and more advanced biofuel technologies seem to alleviate some of these concerns, but in the meantime, we do think it should be a concerted effort to make sure that the sustainability of biofuels going forward is actually a net benefit and ensure that the emissions reductions are actually achieved through the use of biofuels. In the improving energy security characteristics of low-carbon technologies, we deal with renewable energy. I know it sounds like we don't know what we're talking about. We put them in the all-positive category before, and now they're here. What we meant is, you know, unless you do something about the intermittency of renewables, a problem that you can probably overcome using a smart grid, a more modernized grid that can sort of manage the input of these renewable energies with other baseload power generation options, that renewable energy still poses some security problems unless we're able to get over the intermittency issues that would deal directly with reliability concerns. The other option would be more advanced power storage options as well. The second one is improving the safety, waste management, cost, and proliferation risks currently hindering the expansion of nuclear power. We here at CSIS have been running a very long and well-attended nuclear event to deal with these issues in particular. I'd like to point out there is a nuclear renaissance going on just other places around the world. So these issues will have to get dealt with one way or the other because we are part of the global community. So dealing with some of the proliferation concerns, some of the waste concerns, all of those things are necessary for us to be able to have nuclear energy, which is, in fact, a low-carbon fuel. The first step for this recommendation is to sort of make sure that we're evaluating our federal technology policies in light of both the climate and the security and economic benefits that they derive. And so to make sure that we continue to be looking at how we spend our technology dollars and demonstration dollars through that lens. Only two more folks. We've got This one is supporting domestic oil production during the transition to low-carbon fuels. And it is really important to mention that this recommendation deals explicitly with the idea that it will take us a long time to transfer to something new. We did have a recommendation in here earlier about sort of dealing explicitly with the transportation sector and the need to shift to a new system that had greater efficiency and greater diversity in fuel choices. This one is the recognition that going forward we need to make sure that the current system continues to work in absence of a scalable alternative. And so we do promote the continued domestic production of oil in the near term as a key security measure. We think that it's we talk a lot about in this section about how this is one of those recommendations, along with all of the others, that need to be considered as part of a concert of recommendations, things that are done for security and environmental reasons as well. All of the production needs to be done in environmental ways. We need to keep that in mind as well. And the first step under this is develop and implement policies to improve production technology, enhanced oil recovery, and prioritize production in areas that have the greatest production potential and are the least environmentally sensitive. And the final recommendation is to develop a natural gas strategy with appropriate environmental safeguards to meet short-term demand and ensure availability of alternatives in the longer term. When we looked at sort of near-term considerations of this transition and we looked at imposing a cost for carbon, one of the things that became quite self-evident is that in the near term, natural gas makes a lot of sense as an alternative, lower carbon alternative to coal. And so how well we've been thinking about the role of natural gas, the changing role of natural gas in the United States and around the world, we're actually, again, conducting a paper on this as well. As one of the people working on it, I'll say I don't think people have a very sophisticated way of thinking about this. We talk a lot about having a lot of unconventional gas resources. We don't really look at what the greenhouse gas implications of unconventional gas sources are. The longer-term implications of switching, near-term switching, fuel switching to natural gas for longer-term goals for switching to things like renewable energy and other low-carbon fuel options. So one of the first things that the first step for this was to develop a natural gas strategy to address the strategic implications of natural gas in a carbon-constrained environment. It's not, state planning by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just to think about it. It's to look at natural gas under these different carbon-constrained scenarios and think through some of those issues.
So let me try and wrap some of this back up. So here we have a set of really 10 large framed recommendations, which, as Sarah's walked through, a series of sub-elements. And this is an effort to be fairly comprehensive. But having said that, it doesn't go into a vacuum. I would note that we began this work well before the decisions on the election. This was meant to apply to any government in a nonpartisan sense. We were thinking about ways to think of connecting these two problems, because if we were able to do that, we thought we'd have a robust solution. Over the course of the next year alone, it looks as if we will have a number of opportunities to test these kinds of recommendations. Perhaps the one that's most current is the stimulus package discussion. So already this is probably dated. The $70 billion in infrastructure that go into relevant areas is a constantly shifting number. I've seen at least three people on the phone over the course of the last 2 hours in stimulus discussion phone calls. So it's happening right now. But at the same time, the kinds of recommendations that we're making we think could be incorporated into those decisions. If we decide to link these things, we can succeed with some of these recommendations that merge a more effective climate program with an effective security program. Part of it's being done. The $70 billion is an interesting down payment. If it's followed, will it be moved forward? How will Congress react to it? Remains to be seen. We had a meeting not very long ago, about a month back, with Senator Bingaman. He's expecting that the first bill on the broad set of climate and energy components will not be the climate bill. It will be another energy bill. So what's the framework of that bill? How does he incorporate and how does his committee work to incorporate these kind of elements? That's a this year exercise. That's an area where, working jointly, we could find ways to marry these security discussions. He's got concerns around natural gas. He's got concerns around energy infrastructure. He is incorporating into that some underlying issues around the grid. Managing those questions clearly can be good, and we think if he takes some of these recommendations, we might see those kinds of improvements. Shortly after that, whether it is going to happen quickly or not quickly remains to be seen, we had a hearing about a week and a half ago in which the U.S. Climate Action Partnership was testifying at the first hearing organized by Mr. Waxman, who's the new chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He indicated that he anticipated having a first draft legislation through his committee by the Memorial Day recess. It's awfully quick. But the point mostly is that if he's going to do that, he has a chance to think about these kinds of recommendations. It will be part of the conversation in that House committee. It will be part of the conversations on the floor. Senator Boxer's indicated that she would like to see something move forward. She hasn't been as explicit about timing, but the consequence is that there is an opportunity, and it will be taken, and we can collectively perhaps influence it with some of these better choices if we can move forward. We are currently scheduled to conclude the negotiations on the next international agreement. It follows something called the Kyoto Protocol, which was agreed in Kyoto, Japan in 1997. We're supposed to have the next agreement resolved in December of this year in Copenhagen. Again, a huge window of opportunity and an enormous hurdle to overcome, because managing that requires that we not only have our own domestic framework for energy and climate policy, at least fairly far advanced, but that we have a chance to engage with the international community to frame the things that we as a country want and that move us down this global pathway. We have only that one formal recommendation about engagement. Clearly, the engagement has moved forward. The day before yesterday, Secretary Clinton announced a new climate change envoy at the State Department who will have a responsibility including energy and climate change, linking back with the issues of climate spoken to here and the issues of energy and clean energy and the framing of those internationally. And we have clearly the indication that the National Security Council will be engaged. Jim Jones has indicated he's very interested in these kinds of questions. We've got a clear sense that Secretary Chu is very interested in the international component of these questions. How will they frame themselves? What are the opportunities? That's a this year context. And then finally, we've just seen the kind of rapid price fluctuations that are a consequence of the global economy, but also of shifts in investment, also of changes in political perspectives from some of the key producing and consuming countries that will undoubtedly continue over the course of the year. And it's in that fluctuating and dynamic context that these kinds of recommendations have to be seen. We're not in some static world in which there is an answer and it will hold absolutely without change over the next 5 years. We're in this much more amorphous circumstance where things are shifting. Our collective view, and I think the collective view of those who participated with us in this effort, is that these kinds of recommendations should be robust against those changes. This is a set of recommendations that's not contingent on one bill, on one set of narrow institutional frameworks. Set of recommendations that in total yields what we think would be an improvement, a significant improvement in the larger effort for a secure economy, secure energy system, and a secure climate change future. So I think with that, I open it up to questions. Frank?
Yeah, let me just make a final couple comments. Echoing the robustness comment, when we looked at these recommendations last July, decidedly different economic environment, energy environment, they stood up in July, they stood up in January. So we're actually pretty pleased by raising the level that we're able to make it robust and flexible, which is what a new administration is going to have to do. Point on transitions. We've done at least two transitions before. Between 1850 and 1910, we went from 75% renewables to 80% coal. Between 1910 and 1970, we went from 80% coal to 65% oil and gas. It just takes time. It takes time, investment, and you have to be forward-looking. We largely agree on the future. We largely agree on the reset. And I would argue just on the point of the reset, for those old of you enough to remember the Carter administration back in the 70s, in a five-year period in the 1970s, Republican and Democratic administration, we did clean air, clean water, CAFE standards, decontrolled oil, decontrolled gas, established the SPR, put together the IEA, and developed a Synfuels Corporation for the day when conventional energy wouldn't be available. So it's not like we don't know that these problems exist, but it's time to reset that system. The last system worked pretty well for the last 25 years because we were in a surplus type of situation. We're not in that situation anymore, and we've looked at the viability. When we looked at just depletion rates against the demand center, we didn't focus a lot on oil just in this study, but if you just look at depletion rates, we have to replace the entire system by about 2040. That's 7 or 8 new Saudi Arabias, depending on what you look at their current production as. For a variety of reasons, geologic, geopolitical, economic, investment, environmental, this is kind of an unsustainable future, the business-as-usual future. So this idea that we have to change comes from a variety of perspectives and angles. And what we're trying to do is put together a plan to propose for a way forward that's unified, comprehensive, and stands up to a variety of different changes. So, yeah. Questions?
Just before we take questions, I just wanted to mention that the report is going to be available online on February 13th, so you can get much more detail than what we presented today. And then we also have the other reports online. This presentation and the webcast of this will be available online at these sites that are up on the slide as well.
My name is Hattie Babbitt. I'm here with my WRI hat on, and I want to congratulate you all. I just think this is an extraordinary effort to bring together these two presented as sort of two different strands of the same set of issues. I wanted to sort of bring up a third strand, which I think is going to be important in terms of bringing this all together, and that is the political will to make this transformation happen. I was just reading about World War II and how it was that the population was mobilized to contribute to that and to say yes to things that they would otherwise not have been inclined to say yes to, perhaps. The best advertising minds of the time didn't at that point say, you know, see the USA in your Chevrolet. It was a ditty, in effect, that said, blah, 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 I've forgotten the first two parts, and make do or do without. It was a system where I don't want to paint this as rationing being a response, but I'm saying that there was a public which was educated about what was going on in a way that I think that the public isn't. Those members of Congress who are going to be passing those bills go home to constituents who are worried more about traditional things than they are worried about the things that people in this room are deeply concerned about. And where does that national mobilization, much less the international mobilization, come from? What's the headquarters for that?
I think that's underlying almost all the major change that we've seen or that we want to see. I would say probably two things about it. The first one is that I think we're seeing some of that change already. I'm reminded by your question of a number of the polls over the last 15 years on the way the public perceives issues and how they are linked. So 15 years ago, climate change did not break the top 10. In the run-up to this presidential election, it was in the top 3. That's the highest it's ever gotten. It's now back down again, and one of the reasons it's back down again is because the economy is now number 1, whereas earlier on in the election, the international security was number 1. So this kind of fluctuation of the space suggests that people pay attention, and over time, it is a matter of public education and public information. But the fact that it's moved up and it's now linked, and you see more and more stories in the press, more and more political figures making these connections. Just as an anecdote, we at WRI have had an opportunity over the course of the last almost 2 years to do a lot of work in the states. And I don't want to speak for the moment about the East Coast or the West Coast, which are historically always presumed to be the guys in the lead, but about some work we've been doing in the Midwest. And you think about the Midwest as taking on, it's a major coal-producing region. It is a major electric through coal providing region. And yet, if you look at the statements made by Republican and Democratic governors, climate change and energy security have now been linked with their provisions in terms of new policy. I think it's that kind of education that suggests that the issues have risen to the point where we might actually deal with them. but it's clearly a public requirement that has not yet matured fully.
I think there's two other pieces. Just before Thanksgiving, there was a group of us, several in this room, Senator Nunn and Senator Cohen put together a group down in White Oak that talked about energy security and climate change. And the value add was, so what do you do about it? Whether it's the energy summit or every time people get together, they agree on 80% of the steps forward, but how do you get that out there? And I think part of it is public education and leadership. The press that were there, I think, have gotten immeasurably better at writing energy stories over the last 3 years just because they've had to learn because of the high price and the geopolitics piece. The climate change piece as well, I think it's much more sophisticated. The fact that these forums are going around town to talk about the intersection and how we deal with it, and that there's studies, Jerry, the DOD study, there's a number of things, CFR, doing the same thing, trying to get the word out. And the last piece, I think, is, and again, falling back to the campaign, there was this kind of website email system that was set up. It's an electronic way of distributing information, and it was so sophisticated that on the morning of the election, when I turned on my computer, I got, "Good morning, Frank. Have you voted yet today?" And then a MapQuest map picked up and said, "This is your nearest voting place." I suspect that this will continue to be used. So it's not only going to be grass tops and policy people from the top, but there's going to be an effort by this administration to go out to the public at large and push kind of a bottom-up approach to this. So I think you're going to see more and more of it. And when you look at the calendar of events that have to occur, it almost has to be in the public's mind.
Mary Ann Koch from ConocoPhillips. And I also appreciated the fact that you looked at energy security linked with climate change, because we find a source of frustration that you can't look at one without looking at the other or you won't accomplish anything. So I wanted to compliment you on that. But I had a couple of comments I wanted to make on the recommendations. It was curious to me, I hear lots of talk about renewable power, portfolio standards. Well, why shouldn't that concept be broadened to low carbon standards? Why wouldn't nuclear or coal with CCS count? And that would actually be very useful for the Midwest and industrial states and states that don't have wind. So I was just wondering whether you would consider broadening that concept. And the other gratuitous comment I have to make is you talked about promoting domestic oil production. How about domestic natural gas production?
We do. Yeah, no, starting at the back end first, I think the last recommendation, talking about natural gas, when you look at current events and what has occurred, there's been 50 coal plants in this country that have been shut down or suspended over the last 18 months. So if you can't scale up nuclear fast enough, and if you can't scale up or deal with the intermittency problem with renewables, if demand goes up, and demand will go up at some point, the logical baseload and peaking fuel is natural gas. There's been a complacency in this country that as a result of the increase in natural gas production, largely from non-conventionals, in the last 2 years, we arrested a deficit and are now in surplus. But I worked with Tosco before I was at Pennzoil, and all shales are not the same. And if you fracture them wrong, you run the risk of losing the production. We found that over a 22 or 26-month period, decline rates can be as much as 60%. Unless you keep drilling, this production goes from surplus to deficit really quickly at a time when we're going to need natural gas. And when you look at it on the international side, to the extent you put aggressive climate change carbon constraints into practice, the EU, Asia, and the United States will all be looking at natural gas at about the same time and these leads and lags to get investment. So part of this is to wake up to the fact on natural gas. There's a period, there's a concern about perpetuating an old system on conventional fuels, and I certainly understand that. And there's a need to transfer to lower or no emissions fuels. But over that time period, you have to have a robust system.
Let me just add on the first one. It struck us as we were working on this that there were different barriers and constraints to different alternative technologies. If we look at the nuclear issue right now, there have been historically substantial subsidies to try and work through some of those cost questions. But we have not yet managed to both alleviate public concern, which underlying that are real technical problems and procedural questions around proliferation and around waste management. So an RPS equivalent wouldn't be the same mechanism that you might choose to install. In the capture and storage structure, we're still short of a technology demonstration regime. We've got all the component parts have in fact been demonstrated, in fact at scale, but we have no scale demonstrations of the whole system compiled and put together. An RPS wouldn't solve that kind of problem. So we tried to make it tailored explicitly to the kinds of barriers and speak in that context to the recommendations and the policies.
Michael Parr with DuPont. Come back to the politics question for a second. I think many things have bedeviled the U.S. trying to have a comprehensive energy policy. Perhaps the most significant is the American public has never felt vulnerable on supply or cost on energy. And so they don't pay it any attention, which has allowed politics to treat it as a regional economic parochial issue. So if you're in the Gulf Coast, you support oil and gas. You're in the Northwest, you support hydro renewables. What's your sense of what it takes to get from that condition to one in which people in the Northwest now actually care about the price and therefore supply of natural gas? We all know that 3, 4, 5 years from now, when the economy is really churning again, transportation fuel is going to be expensive. People get that signal. That's a long time off. What do we do to bridge that time gap?
Start with just one comment on it. I am struck by the difference in the way the American public deals with gasoline prices and the way the American public deals with electricity prices. And in my mind, part of the reason that the nation as a whole is immediately influenced is because the system is actually quite integrated, and that a price change at Henry Hub or at the import line changes national numbers. I think things like a national grid would begin to change our vision about what energy and electricity looks like. I think that these new technology opportunities will change how we frame that going forward. But I think for some period of time, it will be regional, it will be local, it will be more fragmented, and therefore it's going to require a set of political leaders at the regional and local level to make that happen. And it's going to be this composite of these regional interests that emerge in some coalition structure in Congress that gets to an outcome. And I don't think we yet know what that's going to look like.
Yeah, there's a second piece on that. The second piece is that in electricity, you get your bill at the end of the month after you already used it. In gasoline, you see it posted on a billboard every day, and it changes 4 times before lunch. On region, Canada is another piece. You know, this has to be more than just the United States. Our systems have become integrated on power generation and natural gas. And so when you start looking at distribution across borders, I mean, this is an international problem. But I do think, going back to earlier comments, that we went through a period of 25 or so years when we had surplus, productive capacity, refining capacity, excess infrastructure, generating and transmission capacity. That's gone. We've used that surplus because demand broke through. And I think people realize that. The fact that prices ran up so quickly, it was a demand-driven issue and the lag on new investment. So I think people have got that, but I think you're right. I think on the politics of it, what's Joshua, Busby?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At UT, there's a great political scientist who had done a study on gatekeepers. And he had kind of looked at the politics regionally and statewide. And it's not Democrat or Republican. It's by fuel in your state and what the economy is driven by in your state. And so he actually drills down to the local levels. It's a report worth getting. I don't know.
It's on Council on Foreign Relations.
It's on the CFR website.
Okay. Dick Vanatta from the Science and Technology Policy Institute. Sarah, you mentioned the international dimension, and you said that there are some issues in terms of bilateral and multilateral. I was in India in December, and I was talking to some folks in India specifically about coal and specifically about GHG, et cetera, and their answer was, it's not our problem. We have 700 million Indians who don't have electricity. I was there with some people who joined me from the U.S. Embassy. They said they hadn't heard that number before. It was a new number, much higher. So it raised the question of how do they count, what are they counting? And the second thing they said is, and we're not going to address the issue from coal. We're going to wait until we can do nuclear. So it gets to this question you raised in terms of bilateral relationships and more specifically the point about deploying technologies and developing and creating incentives in those areas. And do we have the wherewithal and the interest to do that, and can we get them to be interested in doing that?
Sarah.
He looks at me, right?
Sure.
I don't think we've, as many people probably haven't come to a, a conclusion about specifically what you do bilaterally with India. We do have a number of examples of ways that we've worked with them in the past. What we do in the roadmap is identify places and other countries with whom cooperation makes a lot of sense. For example, cooperation with China on technology and India on technology and technology transfer and deployment, those issues are going to have to get dealt with. I will say, though, that as is always true in international relations, there are things that people say, and then there are things that we can do. And until you understand what the concrete actions are that we can actually do together, you know, what is technology transfer? I hear 8 people say it a day, but very few people know what they're actually talking about. I think a lot of those issues are on the table. A lot of them will get dealt with. I think a lot of, and you know this far better than I do, I think a lot of people are looking to see what the United States is willing to put on the table, and then the tenor of that debate can change as well. But there are definitely things that we should be doing through bilateral and multilateral partnerships, through technology partnerships, which, you know, some of which were actually started over the last 8 years, where we need to evaluate those programs and see which ones apply towards sort of pursuing some of these goals, and a U.S.-India partnership would be chief among them. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Just only one thing that I would add. We did a study about 3 years ago with a group of Indian academics looking at impacts of climate change. They were incredibly sophisticated. The impacts of climate change on India dwarf the impacts of climate change in the U.S., and the whole perspective there, in particular, it was around water and around coastal zone management that they were most concerned, and the water then, of course, by extension into agriculture. And as they look forward, and they're beginning seriously to look forward, and the conversations that you have when you visit there, no longer just with the environment minister, but now with the prime minister's office, and now with the minister of agriculture, and you talk to him, they're beginning to really worry about these questions. And I think it's that combination of these technology opportunities and the perception that it is no longer in the future and the future is now that is beginning to change things. But it'll be slow, and it'll be requiring a level of cooperation that we haven't yet really tried to engage on with them in a partnership that we've never really essayed before.
One of those guys from the my title then was Deputy White House Manager, Deputy Director of the White House Energy Shortage Task Force. So I was right in the middle of the last year. Interestingly enough, the Washington Post just came out and endorsed Carter's proposal in 1979 to put a 50 cent tax on gasoline, which we probably should have done. But one comment about all of what you're saying is putting the government in a central role in working with industry in planning our energy future. That has not worked very well. In 1979, provisions of the energy bill were for just to require oil companies to come up with 10-year plans on development. They refused. That provision got knocked out of the bill. And I worked with the National Governors Association at the time, lobbying like hell, to put it in the bill, and it didn't happen. How do you plan to carry, or what's your approach beyond the console that we now have set up within the White House to get the industry, to get the CEOs to work with the government to recognize that the government needs to sit at the table and make decisions that will affect their markets on energy development?
Well, I think two things. I was also in the Carter administration. I was a child. I wasn't that young. Yeah, thanks. Fine. during both campaigns, and we did some of this, and I suspect you did it as well. So at CSIS, we had McCain, Clinton, and Obama representatives here to talk about energy and environment. We tried to continue the dialogue. We had 2 separate sessions with the McCain folks. We had 3 that we sponsored with the Obama folks. The last session, I think, with the industry, there was discussion that with the exception of a comment that I think David may remember about demonizing a specific company, that ads were ads, but that once we got by the Tuesday into the Wednesday morning, that we were all in this together and the public and the private sector had to work together. The leaders of most of the energy companies have met with the president personally in Chicago. There's been ongoing discussion. There was an expected and I think widely anticipated outreach, and we're going to partially try to fill that gap, because this dialogue has to go on. It can't just be government down, and it can't be just industry standing on the outside with its arms folded. API has changed over time. The National Petroleum Council study, Andy, that was put together involved folks from the Alliance to Save Energy, Resources for the Future, NRDC. It wasn't just the old boy network of the oil and gas community. They came together with similar recommendations, and there was, I think there's a growing understanding that this need to interact, not just to influence, but to be part of the process instead of just be part of the no, just say no crowd. But it will take, I think, on the government side, a statement early on by this administration, personal view, this is a Sarah personal view, that you kind of have to step in and recast yourself, that it's just like you're not the enemy, we have to stop demonizing you. Production in an environmentally sensitive way needs to go on, and it's a high-technology field that also contributes to a lot of jobs. And I would say from the industry side that there has to be a way of recasting the industry's role as well, that it's part of the solution, not part of the problem. And we've started to see that. You've seen CEOs of major companies talk about the need for either a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax from folks that you wouldn't have thought it would come from as recently as 18 months ago. So I think the system is changing. People realize that there's a moving train. They want to be part of it. It doesn't solve the whole problem, but I think the dialogue is going to be better.
Can I comment on the stimulation of why the industry is really going after, at least one of the major reasons, is because the states
have come in and set up systems that essentially are affecting their markets. The RGGI system
Absolutely.
In the Northeast, California doing what they want to do, and they're saying, as part of their message, we want to act at the federal level so we have an even playing field.
Which
and without state action, I don't think we would have seen that kind of...
Well, without, I would say without a confluence of a lot of things happening.
Right,
but if you go back 10 or 15 years, companies decided that it was easier to work with states because they distributed a lot of things regionally. And the Reagan administration actually supported this idea of decentralization and state concept. We've come to the point now, I think, where the pendulum has swung back, and they realize this patchwork of regulation doesn't work, and that's one of the things that's helping drive the train.
Thank you. Could you share with us your deliberations with regard to a tax on petroleum for above and beyond a carbon tax, based on its energy security implications? This report. I didn't hear it as a recommendation.
I don't think we reached agreement either on a gasoline tax or a floor price for oil, certainly not on a windfall profit tax. Again, if you looked at the climate, we were working on this study over the last year and a half. So things markedly changed. This idea of a revenue stream, there's pros and cons about how you generate the revenues from the tax and what you use them for, right? If oil companies, I would argue, are productive, they pay more in income tax. So the windfall profit tax, going back to the 70s, the way that tax and why it's different from, I would argue, from today, is that the government deregulated. And by the government taking off regulations, it allowed prices to rise. Part of the political quid pro quo at that time was, if you're going to let prices double or triple, something has to go back to the people. Companies ought not be able to just reap the benefits of that, so that there was a tax put in place that was phased out. Entirely different situation now. So, no, well, we did not specifically recommend a gasoline tax, but I think it's worthy of discussion in the current climate. All right.
Michał Krupiński, Alternate Executive Director for Poland at the World Bank.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you very much for your interesting presentation. I was particularly glad to see the logic of the triangle, that you have energy security, that you have climate change and economy or efficiency, effectiveness. I think this is particularly important when we look at the latest developments in Europe, with the climate package adoption, where you have leaders from Central and Eastern Europe going to Brussels saying, okay, if we cutting down some of our carbon coal mines, then how will we get the electricity? And the response would be, you can get it from natural gas, which is, of course, not so evident in our part of Europe. Or the second response would be, from some countries in Western Europe, we can supply you with nuclear energy, which, again, given the lack of existence of interconnectors and one transmission grid, is not so simple. So I very much support the logic that if you want to advance with climate change, you have to advance in parallel with energy security and economy effectiveness. And I have two other comments. I think you're very optimistic when it comes to finding solution to the question of coal. What I maybe lacked is a clear emphasis on developing new technologies, clean coal technologies. We know that the existing technologies may not be mature. CCS is very expensive. And even if the U.S. has the resources to invest $30 billion in smart grid and other $150 billion in renewables, then the developing countries, carbon-rich countries, don't have the resources to invest in smart grid and to have everyone have an electricity meter at home. And second thing is, given the revival of the nuclear and the lack of one transmission grid, what I lack is maybe an emphasis on developing transmission grid, interconnectors, and one transmission system in the U.S. Thank you.
Let me just make just a couple of comments about it. I am struck at the changes in the prices over the last 5 years on capture and storage in particular. The first studies that were undertaken by folks at Carnegie Mellon and at MIT ended up with some suggestions that it would cost on the order of about $500 million for a capture and storage incremental cost, above and beyond a give or take some billion-dollar plant. Then we came forward and we had the increase in the price of steel and the increase in the price of cement, and we're now at close to $1 billion in the incremental cost. So I was in China with some meetings with some folks in China about a month and a half ago, and our $1 billion there translates into only $300 million. And they think they can bring it down to half that price. Of course, their coal plant to begin with is substantially lower than our coal plant because all kinds of pricing structures there aren't equivalent to ours. And that's in the absence of any scaling up of the technology. That's in the absence of any improvement in the capacity. And that's not for retrofits, that's for new plants, but the retrofits costs ultimately might have higher energy penalties, but lower operating costs. But in all those cases, it not only brings you off your CO2, but it takes care of all your criteria pollutants. There are a set of these kinds of interlocking questions that have not yet been fully examined, and I'm not sure that the technology is necessarily over-optimistic. I think it's just not very well tested. And that's one of the reasons you need in a set of recommendations not to merely say if the price is right, it'll happen, but to look at those barriers and be explicit as to which ones you're trying to manage and how you do them. I would also note that having been in Poznan for the climate change negotiations, which happened in December in Poland, that there is an enormous issue with regard to how countries that are reliant, as Poland is, in a very, very difficult case. They can't get gas. We think you made it very clear. There's no question about it. The French are certainly avidly anxious to sell nuclear power across the German continent into Polish supply, but it's not going to happen because they're, in fact, looking at increased demand themselves. This dynamic, however, set them up for a politically enormously problematic negotiation inside the European Union. And I think that that's the point, to a certain extent, in this discussion. These things are no longer separate. You can't have your conversation around, I've got coal constraints or gas constraints because of my security problem, and not expect to get pilloried in the international community with regard to your climate change constraints. And they may get evened out. So in the context of Poland, it was largely a deal worked out within the European Union. And they have not yet worked out their global security issues with respect to Russia, but that's going to be part of a conversation that will link these questions. I think to a certain extent, this notion that we were trying to create in our report is about the package. It's about how these things connect. It's why the triangles aren't three separate bubbles that don't have overlaps, but why they're connected and they're linked, and why the solutions to one matter to the solutions to others.
You mentioned, and we're all acquainted, ones that have been involved in the energy picture for a while, about the natural gas issue and what's going on and what you pointed out. Wild fluctuations, all of a sudden you start using it and you haven't got another reserve and we're down to depleting it. Happened in 1978. We had the National Natural Gas Emergency Act, where we brought all the natural gas companies into a room and said, hey, where are we going? We had to have antitrust lawyers, et cetera, and deal with it. Now we're facing ads in newspapers, major newspapers, incessantly about switch to natural gas. Companies, Goldman Sachs and a few investment bankers, have told utilities, yeah, we'll finance you if you build a natural gas base load electric plant. What kind of mechanism do you envision now in working with the industry to not have what you described so that we have an even transition and utilizing natural gas and CCS and others? But I think natural gas using natural gas the way people are now promoting it could put us in trouble 10 years down the road.
Yeah, I think we're vehemently agreeing. The notion that you can use natural gas for everything, transportation, home heating, power generation, you blow through the resource base really quickly. So you have to have priority uses for that. I think our biggest concern is that in balancing the system as you upgrade the renewables piece, that you pay attention to what feeds the current system, and the current system is 50% coal, 20% gas, 20% nuclear, and then renewables. So just to bear that in mind. But I think it'll be a dialogue and exchange process. I hope it's not just going to be a system of regulation that you will do, you know, X by a certain date. We've got a great opportunity here. And the great opportunity is that in a low-price environment, lower demand means lower emissions. We've bought some time. But the economy at some point, one would hope, is going to come back. Demand will come back. And we should have made the investments in the fuels to obviate the need for going through what we just went through for the last 18 months or the last 6 years. If we're smart about it, and this is kind of the balance of the triangle again. You know, one of the pieces of the triangle is that it's got the corners and it's got the intersections. But if you think of it as a dial, you know, sometimes economy's on top and sometimes security is the focus and sometimes environment the focus, but it's the same dial. And so that's the kind of discussion that has to be had, and it can't be – there's advocates for all side in the oil and gas industry, in the coal industry, the nuclear industry, the environmental community, but governance has to balance the views and make sure that the system works. And I guess that's all we're advocating, and we're hoping that at least by putting our two groups together – we started out in decidedly different places, but I think we reached accommodation on an awful lot, and that's the basis to go forward with. Governance and leadership is a big, big role, I think, going forward. Let me thank you all for coming. This was a horrible day to turn out. Lunch was good but not great, but we hope you enjoyed it. I have a cannoli here. We will post on our website both the presentation and the slides. You'll be able to download those. That'll be also on the WRI website. Because of publishing, we'll have an electronic view of the report, as Sarah said, on February 13th. We expect to have a hard copy available by February 20th or so. We've got three other papers coming out, technology, natural gas, and transportation. They may be in the stage of working papers. We hope to get those out in the next several weeks. Anything else I'm missing? No. And thank you all for coming, and thank you, Jonathan and Sarah, Kate,
Jake.
Yeah, Jake. Thanks, Jake, for coming as well. Terrific opportunity. Thank you.